It's Friday, March 19th. This is Jeff Schwartz with the Jeff Schwartz is Smart on You podcast. We have a fantastic guest today. Robert Mays of The Athletic will join us to talk everything with free agency. We'll talk about the Ravens and Saints and the future quarterbacks and what the Raiders are doing. We cover it all. Great to listen to Robert talk about that. Before we get there, a lot of news broke in the NFL late yesterday. The NFL has a new rights deal for their TV and media and digital. It is $10 billion per year. $10 billion per year is a new deal. Doubles what the NFL previously had. The NFL continues to rake in the money. The salary cap will again shoot back up next season now with this new money. But some changes as well. More games on ESPN, the Thursday Night Football package, straight to Amazon Prime. So 100% now, Thursday Night Football streaming. Monday Night Football, ESPN now can be flexed. That's going to be interesting. We'll see when they have to flex those games. Obviously, a lot of plans are in the air if you can't flex those games out, probably more than a week, just for fans as well as players and teams trying to figure out logistically what they're going to do with a flexed Monday Night Football. So the NFL is healthy. The NFL is thriving still. And the NFL will continue to be king of all sports. So with that being said, let's get to Robert Mays. We're now joined by Robert Mays of The Athletic and a excellent long snapper whose career was derailed. His NFL career was derailed by decision in high school. Robert, how are you, buddy?
My college career was derailed. I will say, though, the way my dad tells the story, I was at a camp for long snapping and Justin Snow, the Colts long snapper, was there. And he told my dad that if I ever got to the NFL, that there was a little hitch in my motion that I would have to fix. This is the way my dad tells the story. He was not an embellisher, so I do tend to believe that happened, but I was not present for that part of the story.
That's fantastic. I love that we have a connection through our long snapping abilities. Man, there's so much NFL this week. I'm glad to have you on. As we were preparing for the show, the NFL has announced they will double their media rights revenue to more than $10 billion a season under new rights agreements. Mays, this league is just never going to stop making money.
It's interesting because I think that a lot of teams, you see all the voidable years and a lot of teams that are kind of digging into some financial holes that they typically try to avoid. You know, the Bucks historically have been a team that's always done pay as you go, not a lot of proration on bonuses because they don't want to put themselves in a bad spot. And now they're doing it, and I think other teams are more willing to play with some of the cap gymnastic stuff just because they're confident that as early as next year, this is going to bounce back, that it's a one-year blip, and it's worth borrowing from this year's cap in order to fit some more players in, everything else. So I assume that that number is going to affect how a lot of teams are planning and financing and doing everything they're doing on the books right now.
But we're seeing like a stalled market for wide receivers. And they've been the one position where they really haven't got the money. Joe Tooney got paid. Other players have gotten paid. Why is the wide receiver market still not caught up to everyone else?
I would say, in my opinion, and if I were looking at it and how I would pay them, it'd be coming from two different directions. One, I think that paying for wide receivers is not as wise as it used to be solely because there isn't a scarcity of wide receivers. There's a surplus at the position. You think about all the guys coming into the draft and where you can find those guys. Do you want to go pay Corey Davis $13 million a year or Curtis Samuel $13 million a year? Or are you confident you can find the next Curtis Samuel in the second round of this year's draft because of how many guys seem to be coming out annually at that position? And I can understand that. And I also just think that I think that's part of it, but in this year's draft informs that. But me and Nate Tice talk about this on our show all the time. He's a big proponent of the idea that you shouldn't take pass catchers super high. There is more of them available than there have ever been. And if you're thinking about positional value and how that stuff works, there's only one Trent Williams available in free agency. There are five receivers, and that's why you see the scarcity and the urgency and everything else inform those decisions.
So is the wide receiver position going to become the running back position where it's frowned upon to pay a wide receiver a new market deal like you would see a running back get every offseason?
I don't know if it'll get diminished to that degree, but I do think that it is becoming a little bit more interchangeable than it has been in the past. It really does help to have a great one, But how many true number one receivers are there? How many true guys that are difference makers that you'd say, I'm going to pay this guy top of the market money because I think he actually does things no one else can do? I think that that list is shorter than other people probably do.
Yeah, to me, a wide receiver is only valuable to your team if you have the other positions in place. So you can't just grab one to help your team if you don't have your tackle, your quarterback, your corners, your safeties, your pass rushers, your tight end. Like, I feel like wide receiver is a luxury piece for a good football team.
Yeah, I think so too. And I also just think, again, it's where can you find one? You know, there are so few left tackles available, and none of them ever hit the market. That's why the Trent Williams thing was so interesting. So if I tend to look at that, it's like, if I can't find one anywhere else, that's when you invest in something. And just because there are so many receivers around, I just don't know if making a high value investment at that spot is going to be worth it. I think that that's why a guy like Kenny Golladay probably isn't seeing the market he assumed he would, just because how many guys are hitting the market at the same time he does, and how many guys are just available at that spot overall.
Yeah, to me, it's a supply and demand with wide receivers. This year, there's just so many guys available. You can pay someone a little bit less, to your point, kind of get the same production that you would from a Kenny Golladay and not have to pay him $18 million a year.
Yeah, I mean, I don't look at Marvin Jones compared to Kenny Golladay, right? Like, Marvin Jones gets $6.5 million a year. John Brown gets $5.5 million a year. I'd rather try to plug some of those guys in as stopgap options than pay up for somebody in free agency if I'm confident that I can find another guy that can be a true number one receiver on a rookie deal in the second round. I just think that that's going to, if that keeps happening, I think it's going to keep affecting what the wide receiver market ends up looking like in free agency.
Looking at a team that got a lot of wide receivers in free agency and got a lot of whole bunch of everything else, the Patriots. Normally we laugh at teams that go ham in free agency because they don't win, right? They don't win. It's been proven that way. Do you feel this is different because of Belichick's history of winning the NFL?
I don't know if it's – I think it's a little bit different in the sense that they have the money to spend, and but it's not different in that – I think that these guys could be good in New England, right? I absolutely think that they could end up being good players. Hunter Henry and Jonnu Smith are both guys I like. But I also think that they're not special. Like, just because the Patriots are doing this doesn't mean they're reading some magical formula and that's how they're following this. The reason that spending in free agency typically doesn't work is that teams that have the money to spend in free agency often haven't drafted well and often haven't built well in the draft. So I think you can use free agency to supplement some of your roster. Like, I know JPP was traded. They traded for JPP, but that's still an outside addition that the Bucks made. And Ryan Jensen was a free agent. I think that you can have a couple pieces here and there where you spend maybe not top of the market money, but one step down market money on guys. But unless you draft well, nothing else really matters. And I think for the most part, if you look at the Patriots roster, there isn't a lot of that. The connective tissue and the meat of that roster is fairly weak because they haven't found many guys in the draft. You know, if guys like Anthony Jennings, Josh Uche, like Josh Uche is a perfect example. If they thought Josh Uche was going to be a star, or the tight ends they drafted last year were guys that they thought were going to have a bigger role, they wouldn't be throwing all that money around on Matt Judon and the tight ends that they did. And that happens to every team. I'm not trying to, you know, crap on what the Patriots have done, but I think that is a window into the struggles they've had adding reliable ascending talent in the draft.
Does Bill Belichick, the general manager, take away from Bill Belichick the coach's greatness? I think we view him differently because he's kind of not failed as a general manager, but it hasn't been pretty the last 5 or 6 years.
I think that's inevitable for every general manager. I feel like every single team builder and drafter is going to run into dry spells. Remember when the Seahawks were just hitting like triples and home runs every single pick over like a 3 or 4 year period? And like 2010 through 2012, the Seahawks drafted Cam Chancellor, Earl Thomas, Richard Sherman in the 5th round, Russell Wilson in the 3rd round, Bobby Wagner in the 2nd round. I mean, they found a Hall of Famer or multiple Hall of Famers in like 3 straight drafts. Look at what the Seahawks have done over their last 3 to 4 drafts. It's a disaster. I mean, it's an absolute disaster, the talent that they have added through the draft, the positions they've chased. It has not worked out. And I think that's going to happen all the time. There have been teams that have been proven to draft a little bit better. I think that Baltimore is one of those teams. Pittsburgh is one of those teams. Green Bay has done pretty well. But for the most part, I think those cold spells are going to come. And that's the problem, is that now we're now exiting an era where the Patriots found guys like Devin McCourty, Dante Hightower, you know, all of those guys that they had on the offensive line. They just traded Marcus Cannon. I mean, it's Joe Tooney is somebody that they're just let go. So I think we're exiting an era of Patriots drafting, and that's why there's money for them to spend. And there's a transition that's happening. I also think that even if they haven't, when you look at what was happening when they were winning Super Bowls in like 2016, 2017, 2018, it was they used free agency to supplement a roster mostly built through the draft. They went and they got a guy like Kyle Van Noy. They went and found some distressed assets in other places. But that only works if you're drafting well. And now they've entered a period where those draft picks just haven't hit, and they've had to spend in free agency. They're seeing how the other half lives. So that's just a long-winded way of saying, I think that the Patriots drafting and Bill Belichick, the drafter, hasn't been very good recently. But I also think that those downturns and dips are almost an inevitability if you do this job for long enough.
That's a fair point to make. And I do think, you know, that it is, and I'm curious if these guys are good enough to get him back to where he wants to be, but also the quarterback, do you expect them to go find a quarterback in the draft? Because Cam is not their guy long-term. And I imagine the way that he's designing this team, he would want maybe a more dynamic quarterback than Cam Newton.
We're running out of teams with quarterbacks, right? I mean, there are only yes. so many quarterbacks. So let's say, I think Adam Schefter said earlier this week, you can book having four quarterbacks taken in the first 6 to 7 picks of this draft. Okay, that's fine. So which teams want quarterbacks? I mean, if we're just assuming that Jacksonville obviously will pick Trevor Lawrence, the Jets will pick a quarterback at 2 no matter who it is, then that's two guys off the board. Everything that we've heard, you live in Charlotte, the Panthers want a quarterback. They're in play to get one of those guys.
Badly. Yeah.
Atlanta, to me, could be the pivot point. Because right now, as I see it, or I saw it a month ago, it felt like that number 3 pick that Miami has would be a perfect trade candidate. I mean, because with Atlanta sitting there at 4, if you're a team like the Panthers, the Dolphins call them, you want this one? You want your guy? Come give us your future first and a couple more things, because Miami is, it would benefit them to trade down. But if Atlanta now isn't going to pick a quarterback, I think that could change things. Because now, let's say, you know, Carolina moves up to 3 to get the 3rd guy. What happens with the 4th guy? And that becomes slightly interesting. But if 4 teams in the top 10, if the Jets, Jaguars, Falcons, and Panthers all want quarterbacks, I don't think it matters that the Patriots think that Cam Newton is not the guy and they should draft someone, because eventually the supply is going to run out and you're not going to be able to make a move up in the draft for somebody. So teams like San Francisco and the Patriots and all of these teams that, yeah, maybe they could make a move up the draft. Like, there are only so many quarterbacks. You can't just conjure them out of thin air.
That's fair. And I do think that we are at a point in NFL history where we have, is too many quarterbacks the right word to use? Like, we have too many quality quarterbacks. Like, not guys that are winning the Super Bowl, but I mean, I remember when I came in the NFL in 2008, there weren't as many quality quarterbacks.
Yeah, I remember the Jimmy Clausen year. I know you do as well. So yes, we now have, yes. We're now at a place
we don't have that much anymore.
There aren't that many guys. I think the baseline level of quarterback competence is the highest that it's ever been. I think that if you look at offensive efficiency numbers, rule changes. Also, I just think that the way that the complexion of offensive coaching staffs has changed, I mean, I think that for a long time, for, you know, as long as a decade, in the post-Patriots success era and some of the other things that influenced stuff, I mean, for the most part, it was a long time where offensive coaches were making decisions and building systems based on the idea that, well, you know, that's how Bill Walsh did it, so that's how I'm going to do it. And now it feels like there are more coaches who are willing to say, oh, you did this in college, it'll work. So for the most part, I agree. It's easier to find quarterback competency than it's ever been for a whole variety of reasons. But you say that until you're a team like the Bears who has to pay Andy Dalton $10 million a year because you have no pathway to getting a better quarterback than that.
Speaking about Andy Dalton, your Bears have now been rid of Mitch Trubisky. They have Andy Dalton now. As a Bears fan, what was Pace supposed to do? Put it like that.
I think that he was supposed to not take a half measure last year. And I think that was, I mean, obviously, this is a domino effect, right? By drafting Trubisky ahead of Watson and Mahomes, and when people say when you make mistakes like that, it affects the next 5 to 7 years of your franchise, it does. Because that mistake is still affecting what's happening right now. So you draft Trubisky second overall. You go through your first 3 years of Mitchell Trubisky. It obviously isn't working. It's obviously a failure. But the organization feels indebted to the idea of Mitchell Trubisky such that they took a half measure last year to go get Nick Foles. Instead of trying to find a replacement for Mitchell Trubisky, they tried to find someone to have a competition with Mitchell Trubisky. I don't know if Tom Brady would have ended up signing with the Bears, but I know that that was the type of solution they should have tried to chase last year, not whatever was happening with Nick Foles and those half measures. I think that that was the misstep. But as soon as that happened, and now you're in a situation where you're picking 20th overall, you don't have a lot of cap space, there aren't a lot of quarterbacks in free agency. I mean, there aren't the options now that there were right with last year when you had Rivers and Tom Brady and all of those guys. You have trade options. And when you strike out on guys like Matthew Stafford and everything else, the pool starts to dry up. This was always going to happen. I wrote this last June that the Bears were sitting there in no man's land with enough talent to be middle of the road, but not enough talent to find their way out and no clear path to finding a quarterback. I mean, this has been the case for the last 12 months and nothing has changed. I just think that they should have waited out the market last year and tried to sign a guy like Andy Dalton in May when he was released by the Bengals rather than giving up a fourth round pick for Nick Foles. I mean, today Dalton came out and said, they told me I was going to be the starter. That's why I wanted to come here. So it seems like if they would have done that last summer when he had to sign a backup deal in Dallas, maybe he would have been able to do that for 1 year, $8 million, rather than trading a fourth round pick and giving $20 million guaranteed to Nick Foles.
I know that this your Bears fandom might cloud this next question a little bit, but Russell Wilson to the Bears never felt possible. Do you ever think it was actually something that might happen? Because look, the Bears could not give Seattle a fair compensation, in my opinion, for Russell Wilson.
I never was banking on it happening solely because I think that if you look at the timeline Seattle was on with the way that they've built this thing, I don't know how you can possibly justify trading two first-round picks for Jamal Adams 9 months ago and then trading your franchise quarterback for picks. Those two ideas are just in complete contrast to one another. So unless you're getting a ready-made starter at quarterback like a team such as the Raiders could give you with a Derek Carr, then I just don't know how you could possibly do this. And the Bears didn't have that. The Bears didn't have an option to send back to them. So I just didn't know how you could possibly spin it from Seattle's point of view, especially because you're taking a $40 million cap hit. If you do this before June 1st, everything else. Just, there were too many reasons that the hurdles were just too high for it to happen.
How does Seattle and Russell Wilson fix this relationship? I feel like it's both sides. So the way I look at this is Russell Wilson wants more personnel, more passing. I think Pete Carroll wants Russell Wilson to take a little bit of the blame for some issues they did have in the passing game last year. And it actually can be fixed. This can be fixed very easily. Do you see them kind of piecing it together this offseason to make the 2021 campaign work?
I mean, you know this. I think that winning begets happiness. If they win and the offense plays well, then I don't think we're going to have any issues.
Yes.
I mean, last year when Russell Wilson looked like the MVP through seven games, I'm not sure he was worried about not having personnel control or say about how the offense got shaped. So I think the biggest issue here is going to be what that new offense looks like. And, you know, if we're trying to build a scenario, I make a lot of jokes at Pete Carroll's expense because I think it's funny that they are so committed to running the ball and everything else. But when you look at what Russell Wilson does well and what Russell Wilson does poorly, I think that an offense that lives on play action, gets him on the move, gets him out of the pocket, gets him in, you know, moves the launch point, everything else, that makes sense to me. Push the ball down the field, allow him to get out of the traffic. He struggles to see the game sometimes in the quick game and in the drop back game because he's just not very big. I mean, that's not his fault. So I just think that an offense that gets him on the move and allows him to do some of the stuff we saw from the Rams over the last couple of years with Shane Waldron there, that makes sense to me with his skill set. So if that works, also, that offense mitigates offensive line play. If you're doing a ton of play action and you're selling that hard play action, you don't need as good of true drop back pass protectors as you would in a normal system. So again, from multiple different directions, I think this could work. And if it does, I assume we will not hear as much about the problems coming out of Seattle.
Why does it feel like teams who have to invest in offensive line just keep swinging and missing? It seems to me that some teams know how to do it, some teams don't, and the teams that don't, it's just a big glaring weakness they can never figure out how to fix.
I assume, and you could tell me if this is right or wrong, but I assume it's because they misdiagnosed the original problem. I mean, if you don't understand the different factors that lend to offensive line success, then it's hard to fix it. So if you don't understand how scheme fits into it, how your coaching staff can help guys, whether it's with, you know, certain protection calls or preparation or the ways that you help your tackles out in pass protection, and then how the quarterback plays into it. Does the quarterback understand protections? Is he the one setting protections? How much does he help his offensive lineman? Is he holding onto the ball? There's so many different factors that affect this. And I think that if you're sitting there saying, all we need to do is have better players as those five guys, if we do that or pay more or spend more or use more resources, we will fix this problem. I think that's a misguided approach when it's actually something that has multiple causes. Unless you identify all of those causes, you're probably going to be left disappointed.
I asked you that question because you're a big offensive line enthusiast. I'm not sure there's anyone outside, maybe Brandon Thorne, who never played the position, who like loves offensive line. How did your love for offensive linemen grow? Because I'm so curious. You I don't say this often, like, you know what you're talking about with offensive line play. It's very impressive.
I did it in high school. I mean, I played offensive and defensive line in high school, and I really enjoyed that. And then as I continued to watch the game, as I got older, even as I got more distance from that, it's just what I've enjoyed watching. You know, I remember, I think a really pivotal moment for me when I started watching like all 22 in the NFL was some of those like 2012, 2013 Ravens offensive lines. When I was watching Marshall Yanda and Osemele and those guys play together, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the intricacies of it. I liked watching why things worked and why things didn't. And I mean, I don't know anything about football, like inherently, like that whatever I knew from playing has long since become irrelevant. I only know by the questions that I ask, and the questions I ask are fueled by what I'm curious about and what I want to learn about. And that's, I enjoy watching and learning about offensive linemen. I enjoy sitting here with someone being like, explain this to me. And that's an area of the game that's always been the case. I mean, I remember sitting with Marshall Yanda at like a little plastic folding table in Baltimore at their facility in Owing Mills and just pulling up plays on my phone that I had saved. And I just like, explain why you're doing this. Like how do you do this? How do you know when to come off this? Like, what do you see here? I mean, it's always been the case. I mean, I had just moments in the Green Bay locker room where I'll be like standing there with TJ Lang or David Bakhtiari, and I'll be like, all right, just show me. Just like when you're doing this, show me. And they will. And that's how I learn about it. And that I just enjoy the process of it. And I think that's probably the reason.
I think for us, when you come to us and say, hey, man, like, tell me about this play. Tell me about this. It's exciting for us because a lot of times we get asked questions by someone who has no idea what they're talking about. So when you come to us and be like, hey, man, tell me what happened on this exact play. We love to share those things. We love to talk about offensive line play. And when someone comes to us the right way, we're so willing to share.
I think that I've learned a lot about how to approach this stuff as I've gotten older. And I think that when I was younger, as a reporter, I always thought it was important for me to show people how much I knew. You know, I would try to walk into these conversations and act like I was an expert on whatever topic that I was asking about, because I thought that would give me credibility in the conversation. And I no longer think that's true. I think that you should do enough homework where you can ask questions that are informed and you have direction to the questions you want to ask. But I think walking into those conversations, understanding that you don't really know anything, is very important. So I think showing interest in whatever area of expertise the person you're talking to has is important, but also understanding the gaps in your knowledge is important. I think that you have to kind of hit that sweet spot in between those two things.
How have you found the best way to learn? Because I've been asked many times, like, hey, how do I start, you know, learning about offensive line play? I don't have a great answer. I mean, you played in high school, so that was a good start. But I don't have an answer for someone, you know, a great answer for, like, how do you learn? How do you, or how did you start to learn the game to where you can consume it and then process it and kind of regurgitate it back out?
I'm lucky in that I can talk to coaches and players. It's part of my job. So that, I mean, that's a huge advantage where I can just say, I remember a couple of years ago, I can't remember what the story was. I think it was about how they were using 11 personnel, like a really high clip, the Rams. And I did a story and I was talking to Aaron Cromer about it. We talked for like 20 minutes. And that's a privilege that I have. When I'm curious about an aspect of offensive line play and I want to report on it, I can ask the media person at whoever team that I'm going to visit and say, can I sit with the offensive line coach and ask him about this stuff? And sometimes they say yes. So that's an advantage that I have. But other than that, I mean, I do the same things a lot of other people do, I assume. Like, I have some of the cool, like, convention DVDs and videos and books. I mean, I have, like, often I'm looking at complete offensive line, like the, what's his name? Rick Trickle, who was the offensive line coach at Florida State for all those years. Clint Trickett, I think was his name. Somebody. I don't know who it was, but I'm sitting here looking at it. It's complete offensive line. It's in my books. So it's stuff like that. I mean, I try to watch coaching clinics in my spare time. I think that I've learned a ton on that. There's so much available online. And I listen to other people who are smarter than me. Like, Brandon actually knows what he's looking at. He knows how to grade and scout offensive linemen. I don't know how to do that. So when he talks, I listen. When you talk, I listen. You post videos. I try to engage with and consume as much content about it as possible in order to make sure my knowledge is up to date and it's as, you know, as detailed and as nuanced as it can possibly be. I don't know much. I legitimately do not. I try to learn as much as I can, but there are a lot of gaps in how much I know about those positions.
Well, we knew Trent Williams was going to get paid, and he got paid a lot of money. Now, the deal came out, and it's really two separate three-year deals. It's like a three-year deal, and then I think a team option for another three-year deal. At his age, were you surprised he got paid $23,010,000, I believe it was, per season?
No, because the fact that he couldn't be franchised allowed him to truly hit free agency. And who is the last elite left tackle to actually hit free agency?
Oh, good question. Do you know the answer? I'm thinking about
no, because it's almost been like 10 years.
It's almost like in the Chiefs trying to get Trent Williams. It's almost like Willie Roaf, who went from New Orleans to Kansas City.
And how long ago was that? Like, 15 years.
I'm trying to think of that was in early 2000s. So like. Because, I mean, trying to think of who else. And, you know, Willie was the same age. He was like 32 when he left New Orleans. So they probably thought he was done playing, right?
Yeah. Who are the best left tackles of the last, like, 15 years?
Because Joe never left anywhere, right? Teron Smith ain't going anywhere. If he does, he's not in his prime anymore. Bakhtiari is not going anywhere.
Armstead.
I mean, Mitch is an example, right? Mitch is like an example at right tackle, honestly.
Right tackle, it happens. Right tackle, it happens every once in a while. You're going to have
never does.
You're going to have some hits. There are no left tackles ever available in free agency. So the fact that he was able to truly hit free agency because there was that stipulation where he couldn't be franchised, and you have teams like the Chiefs, you know this, it only takes two or three to pump up the price. And when there are two or three teams involved at a position where there is no one else at your level, it's the same conversation we're having about receivers. There are guys in a comparable tier of player at that position and available options in the draft, it gets diminished. But when there are no other players in your tier at your position and you're hitting free agency at a high impact spot where positional value is as high as it could possibly be, that's how you get market-setting deals no matter how old you are. I mean, Corey Lindsey just got a market-setting deal at age 31, and he's not Trent Williams, so I was not surprised.
You mentioned the Chiefs just won. I'm not curious how invested they were in Trent Williams. I kind of get the sense a lot of times teams say they are to get their fan base going, but, I mean, they paid Joe Tooney. Like, they weren't really, in my opinion, $23 million a year for Trent Williams, and you just paid Joe, like, that doesn't feel...
It would have been a terrible idea.
Like maybe what they did. But nonetheless, we saw what happened in the Super Bowl when everyone was hurt. They released my brother. They released Eric Fisher. I get it, right? Both guys are a little hurt, a little older. But if you're a Chiefs fan right now, you have to be a little worried about the offensive line, right?
Yes. And that's why I think that Joe Tooney is a really good player. I also think that he's so versatile and reliable. It only takes one injury, but he's been healthy. He's been on the field. He's been available. All that stuff matters. Also, he can play tackle. He can play center. We've seen him do all those different things. There are a lot of different layers and steps as to why his value is as high as it is. But I also think that a guard only does so much for you. So if you're paying Joe Tooney $16 million a year, is that better than being able to pay a guy like Matt Filer or Kevin Zeitler $7 million a year and then having another $9 million to potentially chase a stopgap tackle option?
Yeah.
I just think that the ways that they've spread the money out here leaves something to be desired and still leaves them with holes. I mean, I don't know if Kyle Long is expected to play a right tackle for them now. I mean, he was a guard for most of his tenure in Chicago at the end. So there are still big questions. I think it's a lot of money to spend on one spot when you need to fill several.
This is the debate I had with Chiefs fans that wanted to sign Trent Williams. I said, look, guys, you could spend $23 million on Trent Williams or sign Riley Reiff and Zeitler for both that. I think Riley Reiff is, I play him in Detroit, so I like him. In Minnesota, I think the offense fits him great in Kansas City. You could have signed two guys for that one price. To me, that feels like a win, and people want Trent Williams so badly. But the Chiefs have to, this is a great example of the window in the NFL, right? Like, they have to win now. They don't have an opportunity. You can't say in 7 years from now, you're going to win. You have to replace Travis Kelce. You got to replace Tyreek Hill. You know what Pat's going to be. So they still have a lot of work to do. And would you be worried as a Chiefs fan, just in general for next season, with the team they're rolling back right now? Because I'm worried a little bit. I still will root for the Chiefs. But I don't think anyone in the AFC can beat them, though, still. Who's beating them in the AFC?
I don't know, man. Buffalo's pretty good. And they have most of that team coming back. Like, Buffalo did exactly what I thought they might do in free agency, in the sense that they paid their own guys. They're running back the formula that has worked for them with a couple little tweaks. And that's exactly what I think they need to do. I want to see what they do up front. How they go get one more edge, one more defensive tackle. It's when you look at what they've done in terms of their free agent strategy, it's been really smart. They've spent a lot in free agency, but it's also been short-term deals that they can get out of. They kind of use free agency as a way to recharge, right? So how do you stave off for regression? I think it's by sprinkling in a few new elements, whether it's schematically or personnel-wise, every year. So by swapping out an injured John Brown for Emmanuel Sanders, that gives you a little something. If you can trade for Zach Ertz, that gives you a little something. I think that you need those little finishing touches, and that's what Buffalo has done. I don't see why it would be unreasonable for them to be as good or better next year than they were last year. Typically, I'm hesitant to say that because regression is real and teams fall back to earth and everything else, but I still think that they're looking at this the right way, in the sense of, all right, how can we make sure that we don't get stagnant, both with the X's and O's and the players we have on our team.
Isn't there regression for Josh Allen this year? I mean, there's no way that he's able to play at that same level, right? Or are we just still underestimating him?
Let's say he doesn't play at that same level. Let's say they're the sixth best offense in the league next year, but instead of the third best offense in the league or the seventh best offense in the league. Their defense played much better over the second half of the season. I think that even if there are slight variations in, again, efficiency on offense, all that other stuff, to me, if you play the season 100 times, they still have enough talent and they're still thinking about this in the right way and adding in the right way that they win 10 games way more times than they win 6 games. If that makes sense. So, even with a little bit of regression, right, I still think they have the makings of a championship caliber team.
God, if that happens, I'm going to have to delete all my Bills tweets. The Bills fans are going to come hard. I don't delete tweets. I'm not going to do that. But Bills fans they came hard at me last year. If they had beaten the Chiefs, it would have been a bad.
Listen, man, I have some bad Josh Allen takes in the history of my career. I think all of us do. I managed to get back in the good graces, though, because I went there last year and wrote like an earnest story trying to examine how he was, or 2 years ago, how he was or was not getting better. Like, I sat down with him and wrote a story about how quarterbacks improve and how they try to improve, because I'm wrong about a lot of stuff, like, often, but when I'm...
We all are. It's our job. Yeah, we're going to be wrong. We make predictions. We make opinions. We're going to be wrong.
I talk in front of a microphone for like 4 hours a week. Like, there is a lot of stuff back in... There are a lot of skeletons in those closets when it comes to takes that I've had. But when I notice that I'm wrong, I don't mind changing my mind about it. And I'm very open about that. It's like, I said this thing. I have gotten new information about said thing and now think something differently about that thing. I don't think that there's some weakness in admitting that as I experience new things, it changes my impressions and outcomes and everything I see about the world. Like, I don't, that's not like a weird thing to me. Like, I don't think that makes you a flip-flopper or someone that's doesn't have conviction in his takes. I think it makes you a sort of like an actualizing person, or at least I try to think that about myself.
Well, it makes you normal, and it makes when most of us that are secure in our position, we're like, okay, we made a mistake. The funny thing about fans, it still strikes me as so odd. So, like, Twitter can be a rough place to be, right? So I follow the people I like, right? I follow the people I like. Do I agree with everyone's opinion? Absolutely not. But I follow the people that I like. The people that, like, want the approval of someone they don't like. So, like, say, I don't like Jeff Schwartz, but I want him to tell me that Josh Allen is good now. That seems so weird to me. That's a weird mindset. I don't need the approval of people that don't like me. Why do fans do that? It's so odd to me.
To me, it's just funny that the idea that we're out to get people and that there are certain fan bases. To me, the thing that really upsets me these days, and just not upsets me, but it just annoys me, is that when someone will say something along the lines of, like, you national media people, you just hate this team for this and this reason. It's like, there's no summit, man. Like, there is no annual gathering of the people who cover the NFL nationally where we get together and we're like, these are the takes this year. This is the company line of national football reporting. We don't like the Bengals and we like to make fun of the Jets. That's it. So do not stray from those ideas. It just doesn't exist. Like, Washington was a joke for a decade in every single decision that they made. I think a lot of the stuff they've done over the last year has been great. It's been really smart and thoughtful, and the ways that they're building, I think, are interesting. And now that I'm seeing that happen, I'm more than willing to say that interests me. Like, I don't care enough about any one or two teams to become entrenched in my positions about those teams, except for the Bears. Like, that's it. Other than that, I care. I love football and I'm interested in football. And I care so much about the intricacies of the X's and O's parts of it and the team building parts of it. When there are things that I think are interesting and progressive and thoughtful and all of that, I'm going to be attracted to those things no matter what team is doing them.
What is the next progressive wave that's going to hit the NFL? Like, we're seeing teams embrace analytics. Not all the teams. Most of them are. We're seeing them do some virtual reality. Well, obviously, the schedules have changed now with COVID, and they might never go back to the way they used to be, the way we practice or nothing. What's the next big progressive wave, you think, in the NFL?
I think it'll be how the player tracking data informs certain ideas. I think that'll be a huge thing in how scouting is done, too. You know, Daniel Jeremiah has talked about that. I don't think that's a new idea. I think that, for the most part, that's going to be how we evaluate players. You know, there will be moments where people don't even think about 40s anymore and you use the player tracking data in specific ways. I think that overall, the way that we're thinking about how player tracking data affects certain databases, whether it's like play types, formation types, just the amount of sheer data that is available about, like, what players do against certain coverages, all of that, like, the numbers on that are going to be more thorough than they've ever been. And I also think that a lot of that stuff has been around, you know, for the past 4 or 5 years. I can't remember what the service is called now, where you can map it all out, like the formations and everything else, and they have the numbers on that. A lot of teams have it. Most teams have it. But I think that the question is going to be, are people in decision-making positions going to embrace those ideas? because even if you've had an analytics guy or an analytics team that's been thinking about that sort of stuff for the last 5 years, does your head coach know about it? How deep can you penetrate to the decision maker side of this to really have them thinking about it? And there are head coaches now that are looking, and I know this for a fact, that are saying things like, what did so-and-so team do DVOA-wise on these plays? That exists now. That didn't exist five years ago. So I think it's as much about the types of people embracing these ideas rather than the ideas themselves.
The thing I'm curious about is, because there are definitely teams that use the DVOA. There are teams that look at Pro Football Focus and use their grades. Like, you know, they can, and the example is given with special teams. Like, they're not looking at everyone's special teams film all year. Sometimes they look at the grades. Oh, this guy grades really well. Well, he must be good. Let's go watch him. You know, I think some game plan decisions are made with analytics, but I'm curious, aside from the fourth down decisions, which are very black and white, you went for it, you didn't, here's the chances, here's not. Do you think it's helping teams win Super Bowls?
I can't answer that.
I'll rephrase that. I'll say get to the – how about just like get to the playoffs?
Yes, I do. I don't – for here's an example. I don't know how the Titans think about this, but I do know that them smashing the play action button over and over and over again is a way to increase their offensive efficiency. By building their offense the way that they did and having the plane get built out of the most efficient pass plays you can possibly have, they built a more efficient offense. And I know that there are teams now looking at, all right, what is the correct calibration of drop back, of quick game, of play action, of shots, how deep are these throws? I think that sort of thinking, how you can reverse engineer an efficient offense by the types of plays you run and how often you run those plays, I do think that there are teams thinking that way, yes.
Well, it definitely worked for the Titans. We've seen it work for them. It's done. And a team that embraced analytics a lot are the Baltimore Ravens. And it's very clear Josh Allen will get a long-term contract very soon. I think he will regress a little bit next year, but to your point, they're going to be very good. Maybe we'll get into Baker Mayfield in a second. But what do the Ravens do with Lamar Jackson? Because you're either in this offense or you're not. Doing the in-between thing might not work very well. What do they do with – he's up for extension pretty soon. Like, do you – to me, I would have loved if they signed a wide receiver to see him maybe with a number one wide receiver type player. But are they going to continue to go all in with Lamar Jackson?
I don't know. I don't know.
What would you do?
I think they should. You know, if you're looking at the players available at that position, I think it's going to be hard to find a more dynamic guy that affects the game in the way that Lamar Jackson does. I'll be honest with you. I've had to really redo and rethink a lot of the ways I consider and process quarterback quality over the last 3 or 4 years. Because I was
same.
I was raised in a world where all I understood in terms of who was good were Brady, Manning, Breeze. I mean, Rodgers is a little bit different, but Rodgers was never, he made plays outside of the pocket and could extend, but it wasn't the same as what we're seeing now with some of these guys. So I just think that I've had to kind of check my own biases about how I understand the position in order to understand what's valuable and what's useful and what kind of guy you can build around and all of that other stuff. And even if Lamar Jackson and the way he affects the game doesn't look like the way that Tom Brady affects the game, I still think that if you look at what's happened in the aggregate and the overall impact that he's had, the guy won the MVP and they were a really good offense last year in certain aspects. And I don't think the problems in the passing game are necessarily his fault. So it's kind of like what we talked about with more quarterbacks coming from college and being successful or being tolerable right away, because teams are willing to build their offense around the skill sets of those players. And even if it looks different than all of the other offenses in the NFL tend to, I still think that there is a pathway to winning if that's what your offense looks like and if Lamar Jackson is the trigger man at the center of it.
For me, the concern, and I'm with you, like I basically have just said, like, I'm just not going to say quarterback's going to be bad anymore in the NFL unless it's like a Mac Jones who just kind of is the old school kind of just statue and plays in this Alabama offense and no Bama quarterbacks are ever kind of good. Just everyone's too wide open. Because, like, Josh Allen and Lamar Jackson for 100 years in the NFL would never be good, right? And all of a sudden they come in the NFL, win the MVP, and Josh Allen was second MVP voted. But the thing with Lamar for me is that, and it's, again, it's not all his fault, but the offense looks drastically different in the postseason now for three straight years. They beat the Titans in that game, but Titans had the 32nd ranked defense. They should have played better on offense, and they didn't. That's my concern. So we've had 3 years now of postseason offense looking nothing like the regular season. Is that a valid criticism of them?
Yes, because I think that one of the most important things about offense is, what do you do when they take away what you do best? Do you have a secondary pitch to what your fastball is? And if you don't, that's a problem. If you don't have remedies to how teams are going to... Because if you only do one thing well, and that's just your identity on offense, and if a team takes that away, if you have no other answers, then that's a problem. And we see in the playoffs all the time, you have these super specific game plans. You have these game plans tailored to one... These are one-week little tournaments. Let's unleash this very specific way to attack this sort of offense or defense. I think that's what we see. And they've had a problem with that. And because they don't have the ability to redirect and win in a different way. And I don't know whose problem that is or whose fault that is, but that absolutely has become an issue. You have to be able to do two or three different things when you're playing better competition, sometimes when they have more time to game plan for you, all of that stuff. So that and when teams have a whole year of film to watch on you by the time the playoffs roll around. So I do think that that's real. I don't think it's solely on Lamar Jackson, but I do think it's an issue.
Who's your favorite like sneaky offense to watch? Like we obviously love the Chiefs and the Ravens and the Saints and the Rams. Like, who's the sneaky offense that you like to watch that most people maybe don't think is as schematically advanced as they are?
I weirdly enough, I mean, it's going to look a lot different next year because of the moves they made this week. I like watching the Raiders. I think that they do a lot of really fun stuff. If you look at what they did last year and all of the different personnel packages, and you know, they remind me in a lot of ways of what the Saints looked like in certain years, where you have a lot of 21, a lot of 12, these heavy ideas where they can still push the ball down the field. They have Waller as that like movable piece, the same way that Jimmy Graham was. Like, the Raiders to me were an entertaining team for long stretches of the last 2 years. That's why I just think it's so interesting that they're switching up the formula to this degree when their offense has been a borderline top 10 unit for most of the last two seasons.
Can we admit that John Gruden has no idea what he's doing as a personnel guy? I think he's a good offensive coach. Terrible personnel guy.
Yeah, again, their offense has looked really good. He's a very good offensive game planner. He's a very good schemer. He's a good play caller. And in a lot of ways, I think that's what you want, right? Like, if I were picking a head coach in the NFL right now, I would start with play calling offensive head coaches. That's where I would start, because I just think it is the easiest way to sustain success year in and year out. You know, we've seen that with the Saints. We've seen that with the Chiefs. The Patriots are a different situation, but McDaniels has been there for most of that time, so they haven't had to worry about losing him. I mean, think about what would happen. And I know it doesn't happen that often, right? I think it can be overblown what it takes to what happens when you lose that offensive coordinator. But it happened in Atlanta. And now, what's going to happen in Tennessee? You know, I think that Todd Downing has a chance to be really good there. And I think that he's a really smart guy, and he's, you know, he's had offensive coordinator jobs before, but I think that he learned a lot from Arthur Smith. It could be fine, but I just think that that's how I would build it. So the fact that John Gruden is that for the Raiders, I think is a good thing on its own. But when you don't have a plan for how you want to build the roster, then it becomes less important and less useful. So in a way, John Gruden, the personnel guy, has kind of cut John Gruden, the coach's legs out from under him.
Which is, sometimes we get back to the beginning, feels like what Belichick has done at times as well with the fridge. I want to end with this. You mentioned the Saints, and I haven't written this yet because I don't really write as much anymore, but I really want to do it, and I probably should. The Saints have massively underachieved, and there's no other way about it. They finished in number one or two in DVOA, overall team DVOA, the last 4 years. They haven't won more than one playoff game in a season since they won the Super Bowl in 2009. Why do we not talk about how much they underachieve with Sean Payton and Drew Brees?
I think the playoff success is largely random. Like, I just think that it's one or two plays. Like, If the Minneapolis Miracle doesn't happen, I think the Saints team could absolutely have beaten that Eagles team in 2017. If that pass interference doesn't happen when they played the Rams in the NFC Championship game, they're going to the Super Bowl. That Patriots team wasn't a juggernaut by any stretch. They absolutely could have won that game. To me, it's bounces of the ball. They have been really good for a really long time, and sometimes it just doesn't work out. It's disappointing in the sense that if you're a Saints fan, I can understand being really sad about having one of the best teams in the NFL for a decade, or the last 5 years at least, after that 7-9 swoon, and not having a championship to hang your head on, not having anything, any sort of hardware to speak for it. That's sad and that's disappointing. But I don't think that it's anything the Saints necessarily did wrong. For the most part, I think they did a really good job of building those teams and trying to get the most out of those last couple years of Drew Brees' career.
They left the playoffs 3 straight years as home favorites.
It's tough. I mean, I think that this year is, but Brees was just done. I mean, he was just falling apart at that point.
Oh, he certainly was. Are we the stupid ones for not believing in Taysom Hill, or are the Saints just out to lunch with this contract? The avoidable years thing, not that, but just the general idea of paying a utility player $12 million a year.
I think that Sean Payton is kind of bored. I mean, that's the stance that I've had for like the last 3 years.
But you can take an option quarterback from college and pay him $0, pay him the league minimum to run that offense.
I think that coaches who
I think
creative offensive coaches who have done the same thing for a long time get bored. Yeah. I think it's the same reason that I would just make a team run the ball for 5 yards every single time with the way that I would structure my defense, the way that Brandon Staley did last year with the Rams. That's just how I would build because I would make teams do the boring thing over and over and over again to beat me, because I just don't think you can string together that many plays. I think that the type of offense the Packers were this year, where you had a really good run game, and you had a quarterback who will sit there and flip the ball into the flat for 4 yards every time and doesn't really care, that's rare to me. I just think for the most part, offensive coaches, really good offensive coaches especially, tend to not want to do the same thing all the time. And I think that that is partially how I explain the Taysom Hill phenomenon.
I mean, that's what happened in the Super Bowl, honestly, right? And the Chiefs probably weren't going to win that game with that offensive line, but they should have run the ball a lot more. I mean, Tampa was like, please, run the football. We have 5 guys in the box, and Andy loves to throw the ball.
You have to really be committed to winning in boring ways if you're going to take advantage of a team doing that to you. And most teams just aren't willing to do that. I mean, it's the same thing that happened when they played the Saints earlier in the season. I mean, you look at what the Saints were doing to them in that game. It was all too high, like press underneath, and they were daring them to run the ball, and they did a little bit, but for the most part, it wasn't something they're willing to stick with all the time because it's just not fun. Like, every once in a while, I think we have to understand that these guys are human beings. Like, they want to dial up the shots, and they want those FU plays, and they want it to look cool. Like, even the most ardent of football people, I think, every once in a while want to go outside of themselves and do something awesome. Like, I mean, it's what happened. Like, when the Falcons lost the Super Bowl to the Patriots, like, absolutely, if they had just sat there and run the clock out, they probably would have won that game. But Kyle Shanahan wanted the dagger on play action from midfield, and Dante Hightower gets that strip sack. Like, every once in a while, I think that very human desire to put your stamp on something or show how great you are or everything else can infiltrate decision-making in those moments. I don't think it's that crazy.
The way I explain it to people is that in moments, just like we all do in life, in moments of conflict, in moments of stress, in moments of indecision, we go back to what we know best. Kyle Shanahan, play action pass, right? Andy Reid, pass the football. Sean Payton, pass the football, or I guess Taysom Hill now, whatever it is. But these guys go back to what they do best, and we shouldn't fault them for that. I think coaches get too much grief for going to their bread and butter.
If that pass had been completed, if I love that 2016 Falcons team, which is why I harp on all the time. But if Devontae Freeman makes that block, if he gets a piece of Dante Hightower,
Falcons win that
that's
game.
A touchdown. That's like a 60-yard, like, historic blowout. We own this season. We are one of the best offenses ever. Like, look upon, you know, my kingdom. And like, it's just, that's what that kind of play is. And it just didn't happen. But again, I just think the margins are so small in moments like that. Like, there's so many great plays we forget because the ball bounces a certain way. There are so many plays that just, you know, Marcus Williams, if he makes that play on Stephon Diggs, he makes that play 9 out of 10 times. It's just every once in a while, those bounces of the ball just don't go your way. And I think that we overrate how much those things truly matter in the way that we think about coaches and players and legacies and all that stuff.
Of course we overrate it. We're in the job of making a decision, like, in overrating everything. That's our job. I mean, that's a clean way to put it, though, right? Is that, you know, sometimes it is random, and for the Saints, right? I mean, that you know, that's a good point, right? That you have the Marcus Williams, and you have the pass interference, and it just, you know, last year Drew Brees. It's a valid point. Saints fans will enjoy that because Saints fans hate me right now.
If you most played out the last kind of 5 years of Saints football 100 times. They win the Super Bowl like 50 of those times. Like, they win at least one.
Probably, yeah.
I just think that all you can do as a football franchise is to put yourself in the best position to win as often as you can. That applies to the way you shape game plans. It applies to the way you evaluate players. It applies to the way you think about the draft. That, to me, is all you can do. You can only position yourself to win. In the end, there are going to be things you cannot control when it comes to winning and losing those games. And as long as you continue to position yourself in smart ways, I think the Ravens are a perfect example of that. The Ravens, year in and year out, are never bad because they have operated in ways that give them tiny advantages, whether that's comp picks or trading back in the draft or going for it more on fourth down. They haven't won the Super Bowl since 2012, but they've been much more successful than most teams would be, and they've gotten out of that kind of no man's land at 8-8 that most teams struggle to get out of. I just think that they are the model organization for that exact reason. They consistently give themselves chances to find advantages and don't beat themselves. And as long as you do that all the time, that's all that can really be asked of you.
That's a fair way to put it. I'd rather be a fan of the Ravens than someone who was so up and down. I'm with you because you feel good every year. You feel good like you're going to win a chance to win every year, which is the way you want to be as a fan.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not just – and there are teams that are willing to be okay every year solely because they want to make money and they want to be able to continue to sell hope and tickets and all that other stuff. I don't think the Ravens are content being 8-8 every year in order to allow people to be in the stands. I think that they absolutely want to win, and they're trying to win every single year. So that, to me, is fine. It's not about just being tolerable if you have no ambitions to win. As long as you're consistently competitive and you do want to do the necessary things to win a Super Bowl, I think that's what matters.
I'm with you there, buddy. All right, man. Really appreciate you joining us. New TV money for the NFL today. I mean, this is a great time of year. I just love this sport, man. Like, free agency, new money, cap going back up next year. Everyone's getting vaccinated. It's a great time right now. Thanks for coming on, buddy.
Absolutely, man. Anytime.
All right, great to have Robert join us. You can find him at The Athletic, at Robert Mays on Twitter. He's fantastic. Glad to have him on. Hope you guys had a great week. Be back next week, back home, better audio. Looking forward to it. Have a great weekend, everyone. Bye.